Evening, everybody. Welcome. I hope that everybody had a peaceful holiday break. Kathy and I were here the whole time. We were pretty quiet, and the days went by quickly and easily. And now we come to a new year. And everything is possible. And I want to thank all of you who were there this morning for the memorial service for Mel. Kathy and I felt your love and support. And it's always great and also sad to think of him every year on this day. Not that this is the only day we think of him. So I bet that all of you are a little bit reeling still from the startling news of several days ago about the snatching of the president and the first lady of Venezuela. A rather amazing and extraordinary event, and people are still madly trying to figure out what it all means. And then today, you maybe saw that in Minneapolis, an ICE agent shot and killed a 37-year-old woman who was not, they were not apprehending. She was in a car, happened to be there. Her name was Renee Macklin Good. Jane just told me in the chat when I saw the news earlier, they hadn't yet identified her. We want to dedicate our seminar tonight to that woman who was shockingly killed. And while it seems pretty clearly to be a kind of horrible overreaction by the ICE agent, and there's a video, you know, on the New York Times website, who just shot this woman. Federal government, the ICE people are disputing this, and they have reasons why they think it's somehow a justified homicide, which seems hard to imagine, but they're saying that. And, you know, frankly, the thing that amazes me is that, as far as I know, this is the first time that ICE agents have killed anybody. There have been some shootings and certainly beatings, but it's amazing that it took this long for someone to lose their life over this. And it's going to make the situation of the brutal targeting of immigrants even worse than it already is. And I'm praying that an incident like this will maybe chastise the government and cause it to at least pull back from its more extreme actions. But it's likely to be the opposite. And yes, it is a new year, so new things are going to happen. And I'm probably with you in praying for better things to happen than happened last year. But whatever happens, our firm commitment to the values of compassion and fairness and deep concern for everyone are only going to deepen. And there's nothing that anybody can do to diminish that in us. And we're working every day on our practice to strengthen that. So we hold to that. Nothing shakes that in us. Well, I wonder, you know, we've been we took a 2-week break, and so we had the homework from last time, but with the 2-week break, I don't know if anybody was able to sustain what I suggested that we do, but just in case anybody did or has some thoughts about it, I'll open the floor for a moment before I go on with the Dhammapada to refresh your memory. The homework was to observe so-called good and so-called evil in our minds. In other words, good meaning the mind that's calm, that's compassionate, that's balanced, bad meaning the mind that's angry and full of defensiveness, frustration, and so on. To observe these minds as they appear and disappear in us, and just to see how they feel and what they're like. How do you behave when the mind is this way or that way, and what are the consequences? So I asked you to pay attention to that, study your mind, and so in case anybody has anything to say about that, that you did that and you learned something, or have something to say otherwise. I'm going to open the floor, and Shufi will see your hands raised and call on you if you have something to say. Like I said, I have low expectations here, but yeah, there's Sue.
Hi, Norman.
Hey, Sue.
Well, I actually put a little post-it note on my mirror to remember to think about this question. So I did think about it once in a while. But I had a hard time separating it from just the idea of practicing the precepts. It kind of got conflated with that, but I was noticing the times I was thinking negative thoughts about myself or other people I know. I wasn't worrying about having negative thoughts about certain people in the government and stuff, but I noticed that with some discomfort, I noticed that I had thoughts about friends of mine about, well, why was he so grumpy today? Or why is she so fussy about restaurants? Or just really stupid thoughts that have no meaning. And I exerted myself to just drop those thoughts and realize that it's of no importance whatever, and that that my thinking of things like that with a person, which isn't, I mean, I'm also thinking positive thoughts about my friends and loved ones a lot, so it's not like I'm going around with that all the time. But when I have that kind of negative thought, it interferes with my own relationship and my own pleasure in being with somebody or being with myself if it's me, but that's a more complicated one. So anyway, I think I actually made some headway as I was noticing these things and just dismissing them immediately. I mean, it's different than something really important that comes up that's a problem that needs to be talked about. I'm not talking about that kind of thing. So I sort of appreciated the opportunity to notice the occasional pettiness of my mind and try to let go of it.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, I mean, it's not that such things are morally bad, or you should not think that, or something like that, but it's just that when you observe, just like you're saying, you observe that life is one's own life is diminished and made unhappy by such thinking. And why would you want to do that? Why do that to yourself when it isn't necessary and it's not important? Yeah, so you see that by observation, just like you say. Yeah, I think there's a couple more. Shafi, will you see them and call on them?
Jeff.
Yeah, much like Sue, by actually observing and paying attention to it, I found myself moving much more to compassion. And I found myself being much more compassionate and enjoying the consequences of that compassion. It's really great. And I try to be alert, but with these specific instructions from you, it was very helpful. And I was very aware of when anything like Sue called pettiness or anything like that might have arisen, that it just went away.
Yeah, and when you see it there, and you see how silly it is, and you see the effect on you, then it just sort of falls away by itself.
There are days that I don't drive my car. There are days when I realize that that I don't trust my body to not, have an accident or something like that. I'm just in a bad driving state. And so I sort of sequester myself so I don't cause a problem. And I've been noticing in the last couple of months that I've been in moods where it's just better that I not see people. And that's not my goal, of course, but it's my, but I recognize that I'm way beyond the ability to govern myself skillfully enough not cause harm. So I just hide out, read books.
That's great. Yeah. Right. Knowing one's own mind is a powerful thing. Yeah. Right. We have time for one, maybe one more.
Meryl.
I have a kind of an entry level response to this. It basically, I can go along for actually pretty long time, I think, without feeling much distress. And then somebody crosses me, and what I res my response is, this is work, and I don't want to work. It's kind of like I want to find a whole bunch of ways that I don't have to apply all of the teachings I've studied for the last 5 years, and I just have to laugh at myself. It's like I liked it 5 minutes ago. Why do I have to do this now? It's I don't want to go to work. I just don't want to do it. And I remember something Paul said once. You know how simple things people will, teachers will say in context of deep practice. And it was a simple thing. Is this, how do you do what you don't want to do?
Yeah.
That's, yeah.
Well, my experience is that as you go on doing practicing this way, it is very natural. It doesn't feel like work or a job. It doesn't feel like you're pushing your mind around. Although the chapters we're about to read kind of sound that way, I think in actual practice, it's kind of effortless because you don't, it's kind of like you don't have to make a big effort not to jump off a cliff. You just don't want to do that. That's foolish, and you're not interested in doing that. So it's like that. You don't want a defiled or a mind, or a mind run around by destructive emotions. It's not a mind that you just feel like hanging out with, and so you just say, no, I'm not going there. I'm going to go turn left and go over here, where the mind is not that way. So that's my experience anyway. It's not a job. It doesn't feel like a job or something you have to push yourself into. But
Well,
it takes a while, yeah.
Norman, I thank you for giving me that encouragement, and I hope to get there.
Yeah. Oh, you
What
will.
I actually what I'm saying is it does go along quite a long time that way for me these days.
Until it
However,
doesn't. Right.
and that's what's so surprising, that it still takes work. Still takes going back to zero, and it still means, just I have to give that up and stop bullshitting around, it's just like I do it. It's just
Well, it is humbling to realize that, you never get over some of these things, right?
yeah,
It's
you
stupid
just there
things,
are
right?
things there.
That's humbling, yeah, right. Well, thank you for all of that. What's amazing is that you thought to do it, and that you could be so articulate, all of you, all three of you, or four of you, however many there were, so articulate and honest in reporting your experience. I think that's a big benefit for all of us. Thanks. So we're going to go on to the next couple of chapters tonight, 10 and 11. The translation of the chapter in Gill's version is violence. Other translations are punishment, or the literal translation of the word danda is, as I think Gill says this in his glossary, is stick. or a club, like the kind of stick that you would use to hit somebody to discipline them. This with nowadays with this moment, we're thinking so much about violence, and it's so disturbing in our world. But I think this chapter is as much about punishment, physical punishment, but even harsh words. It has a lot to say about harsh words used to discipline someone. So it's really talking about, again, about the condition of our minds and how we behave on a local level with our friends and associates, or the kind of punishing words that we can use, as Sue mentioned, against ourselves. Although the opening verses, as we'll read, do talk about non-killing or non-violence. And the chapter begins by noting something that has become one of the most famous and wonderful teachings of Tibetan Buddhism that you hear Tibetan Buddhist teachers say all the time. They say everyone is the same in that everybody wants happiness and nobody wants misery. We all share that, regardless of our point of view or, our belief system or anything. Everybody wants to be happy and well and safe, and nobody wants to be miserable and unsafe and hurt. And we look at ourselves and we see that in ourselves. Yeah, I'm like that. I really do prefer if people like me and are nice to me, and I don't prefer at all if people are mean to me and nasty to me. I don't want that. And so I know that everyone must be like that too. And of course, you can find people who seem to crave misery and pain, but psychologists tell us that this is not a natural and a normal state. It's probably the result of some sort of trauma. So it does hold up that we can see ourselves in others and others in ourselves and see that everybody is like us in wanting happiness and not misery. So it gives us a lot of incentive to not do that to other people, not make other people miserable and unhappy, because eventually it comes back to us and it hurts us to do that. So that's something that the Dharma holds to be really absolutely true. And I guess you could dispute it. Maybe you don't think it's true. But I think that when you practice, you just have more access to your own mind and the consequences in your mind of your own conduct. And I think you come to believe that from your experience, that that really is true. And although, in a very short-sighted way, an unexamined way, it might feel pretty good to bully somebody and push somebody around and get your own way. You might feel, wow, I'm powerful. I can make anybody do what I want them to do. If you're self-aware and you have any purchase whatsoever on your own mind, you realize that no, that isn't really fun. That isn't really happy. It just really and truly, on an immediate basis, does not feel good to hurt other people. It just doesn't. And people who seem to feel good hurting other people just are missing a lot about what their lives really are. Now, it's kind of ironic, actually, for Zen students that this chapter is about no hitting with a stick and no using harsh words, because Zen literature is full of people hitting with people with sticks and using nasty words to straighten them out. I mean, that's like the most common thing in Zen literature. And I don't think it's because the Zen masters didn't know about the Dhammapada and were unaware of the fundamental Buddhist teachings about kind words and kind deeds. I think it's because they were interested in a fundamental honesty and sincerity. They were interested in absolute non-hypocrisy, not, being polite and nice and kind because it is conventional and, the rule that one should do that. They wanted real authenticity that came from the guts and from the heart. And they wanted their disciples to understand that, yes, to really be kind is more than just here's a phrase book of kind phrases. Just use these phrases. It's more than that. No, it's like having a heart of kindness that you really feel the kindness. And so that's what they're after, going deep with who you really are and who others really are and what kindness really is, no matter what it looks like. Anyway, what looks like kindness or not is culturally determined to a great extent, and who knows what kindness looked like in Song Dynasty China. And definitely in the Zen culture that we live in our world, we have long ago, if we ever did believe in beating and shouting, we gave them up long ago. And I don't think you go to any Zen place and find people doing that. It would seem almost laughable and absurd. So that being the case, though, let's not be limited to outward shows of polite kindness. Let's not stint in going as deeply as we can into our own hearts and finding the real source of kindness, which is self-understanding and self-transcendence. So I'm going to read the first couple of verses here. That was my sort of general introduction to the topic. All tremble at violence, all fear death. Seeing others as being like yourself, do not kill or cause others to kill. All tremble at violence, life is dear for all. Seeing others as being like yourself, do not kill or cause others to kill. If desiring happiness, you use violence to harm living beings who desire happiness, you won't find happiness after death. If desiring happiness, you do not use violence to harm living beings who desire happiness, you will find happiness after death. So these verses sort of turn on the traditional and common Buddhist belief that this life is not the end. It's not the last life. Life goes on and on after what we call death and the end of this life. So that means that even if you seem to escape bad karmic results from bad karmic actions in this lifetime, in fact, you do not escape those karmic results because you are going to for sure feel them in subsequent lifetimes. And this firm belief or idea is why the Buddhists have never had the problem that theists have. It's like the worst problem in theistic religions, because God is good and God is just. So it really is confusing when you see good people being crushed by life for no reason, and bad people getting away with everything and seeming to be wildly successful. How could that be possible in a world ruled by a good and a just God? And in the Buddhist traditional worldview, this is never a problem because you know for sure that bad always leads to bad and good to good, if not in this lifetime, then in some other lifetime. And if you don't really believe in that, and I think most Western people don't have that cultural belief, and you think that this is the only lifetime there is, although I put in parenthesis here Dogen's teachings about time and all that that are so central to our practice complicates that, but let's just say one lifetime only. The same idea actually still applies, because then you would say, well, rebirth is moment by moment by moment. We are reborn, moment by moment by moment, as we become in every moment a new person. And bad deeds do bring bad results if we look closely enough at the heart. So, outwardly, someone is very successful, sure, and they're a terrible person, but what's the condition of their heart? Somebody might win the game and live a long life, and although they deserve to go to jail, they never go to jail. But what is their life really on the inside? And no one, of course, is able to see that. Not even the person themselves, probably. They may be quite a mess spiritually as a result of who they are and what they've done. And of course, that can't be proven in any objective way. But again, I think that if you practice a long time, you really have a lot of confidence that that really is the case. And you know that, so you don't get mad, you know, when people get away with stuff, because you know nobody gets away with anything. And it also gives oneself a tremendous amount of incentive not to be shoddy in one's own conduct, because you just know that it's eroding of your own happiness and well-being and basic integrity. And you get it, that that's the only way to go. There's no other way to live. The next verse, don't speak harshly to anyone. What you say will be said back to you. Hostile speech is painful, and you will meet with retaliation. And that seems very true. Although, I mean, in the times we're living in, one of the painful things about these times is that culturally at the moment, hostile speech is very common. It's very prized. It's people literally make money on hostile speech. And there's overt hostile speech and there's sneaky hostile speech. Look at yourself, you notice, you know, even though I'm a tough customer and I don't, you know, weep when someone speaks harshly to me, still I have to say that it bothers me. It does bother me. I don't like it. I really feel badly when someone speaks that way to me. So I don't want to speak that way to anyone else. I want to speak to others in the way I would like them to speak to me. And kind speech is a kind of a fundamental Buddhist practice. In one of my favorite Dogen fascicles, Bodhisattva's Four Methods of Guidance, Dogen talks beautifully about kind speech as one of a Bodhisattva's most important practices. Verse 134, if like a broken bell you do not reverberate, then you have attained nirvana, and no hostility is found in you. So it's a kind of a funny metaphor, because, you know, we want the bell not to be broken, right? It's good, a nice bell, it sounds good. But here they're using the metaphor in the sort of the opposite sense. A broken bell here is a metaphor for nirvana, because when a bell is struck, a bell that's not broken, it will vibrate. The better the bell, the more it's going to vibrate. And the vibration goes on for a long time, you know, spreading out around the bell. But when you hit a broken bell, nothing happens. There's no reverberation. There's just silence. The blow is struck, and that's it. It's over. There are no repercussions. There's no noise. And that's nirvana. And that's how nirvana is, not some cosmic, this is what the verse is saying, kind of astonishingly, you know, nirvana is not some cosmic spiritual achievement. And nirvana is simply the ability to live every moment as it is with nothing left over, so that every moment is complete. There are no reverberations. There's no repercussions. You just live the moment as it is. Maybe it's good. Maybe it's bad. And then you go on to the next moment, fresh and ready, just like we're going on to this new year, fresh and ready. We don't know what's going to happen, and we're ready. We don't have repercussions. And that's how to be peaceful and kind. And that's how to live with everyone. As with a stick, next verse, 135, as with a stick, a cowherd drives cows to pasture, so aging and death drive the lives of being. So here we find what the real stick is, what the real violence is, what the real punishment is that this chapter is about. And that is death and the fear of death. That's the ultimate punishment. That's the ultimate stick. And that's the fundamental violence. I think that you could say that fear of death, which is sort of like ingrained into the human character, is the actual source of all violence. That if everyone really got it, that this is what our life is, we're born, we die. This is true of oneself. It's true of everyone else. If everyone really, really, really knew that, there would be no more wars and no more violence. It's fear of death that drives us to the pasture where we perish. A Buddha is one who does not fear death, and that is why a Buddha is kind and never violent, and that is why Buddhas don't die. 136. Even while doing evil, fools are ignorant of it. Like someone burned by fire, those lacking wisdom are scorched by their own deeds. So I often kind of note that the bad news and the good news about practice is that it helps you to feel much more keenly the flames of one's own unkindness or one's own selfish conduct. Stuff you did that you never thought twice about, you now are anguished by when you find yourself doing them now. So that's the good news and the bad news. Because we didn't notice before. We could blithely go along being unkind and cruel in various ways without even noticing it. Now it really bothers us. When we don't practice, when we don't have that much access to ourselves, we don't have that much wisdom, we don't feel our conduct so keenly. And we burn ourselves up without even realizing that we're on fire. The next is a kind of compendium of the three verses put together. Whoever uses violence to harm the nonviolent and innocent quickly goes on to one of 10 conditions: intense pain, great loss, bodily injury or insanity, serious illness or vicious slander, oppression from rulers and the loss of relatives, houses consumed by fire, wealth destroyed, and with the breakup of the body, the unwise one falls to hell. So that's actually, I counted them. That's 10 bad things that happen to you when you are harsh in your conduct, especially in relation to people who are kind and don't deserve it. So this is not that different, you know, from the Christian idea of hell. I'm reading Dante's Inferno lately, and it's very colorful. You know, there's special hells for specific to all the different kinds of deadly sins. And it's not that different from that. You know, if you do bad stuff after you die, and in this case, maybe even before you die, bad things are going to happen to you. So don't do bad stuff. And all religions have this muscle, it seems. They're trying to talk you into doing and being good. And they'll use any means necessary to do that, including threaten you and entice you in various ways, sometimes quite negative ways. And probably, you know, maybe it's good for some people. Maybe some people, you know, who have a tendency to be really nasty or frightened into being virtuous this way. Maybe it works for some. But for a lot of people, of course, it has the opposite effect. You know, it makes you hate the religion. It seems like the religion is so full of punishment and cruelty and nastiness. You want to run the other way. But it does actually have the virtue of being the truth. You know, it really is true that rotten people, you know, are going to be have rotten situations in one way or the other, internally or externally. So it may not be specifically true that these exact things are going to happen in the way that it says here, but it is true that it's not a good idea to do bad stuff, as we've been saying. So the next one, this is a pair, 141, 142. No nakedness or matted hair, no filth, dust, or dirt, no fasting or sleeping on bare ground, no austerities in a squatting posture. Purify a mortal who has not overcome doubt, meaning, I think, someone who is not really awakened. No amount of doing that stuff is going to help. Even though, on the other hand, a person is well adorned, if you live in peace, calmed, controlled, assured, and chaste, having given up violence toward all beings, that one is a Brahmin, a renunciate, a real monastic. So actually, you might not notice it, but these verses sort of illustrate something that was really radical about the Buddhist teaching, and is still radical about it, but it was even more radical in its day. That real spiritual cultivation is an intimately internal matter. It doesn't have to do with, your religious observances, or really even how you might appear on the outside. It's what you feel inside. It's the condition of your heart. That was really the essence of the Buddha's teaching, is that the most important thing is the condition of your heart. You end suffering when your heart is resolved and your heart is fully opened. And that's the most important thing, to really understand your life and live in accord with that understanding requires some kind of inner turning that is hard to describe or explain or point out. And that inner turning can happen regardless of your circumstances. You can be, a monk in a monastery living for thousands of years, and you don't have that inner turning. Or you can be a person living in the household with busy life and even wealth, and you can have that inner turning. So that's what these verses are saying. It's the question of the heart, not a question of what it all looks like on the outside. You can look very pious, but not really have true awakening. Where in the world does one find someone restrained by conscience who knows little of blame, as a good horse knows little of the whip? Like a good horse, alert to the whip, be ardent and alarmed. With faith, virtue, effort, concentration, and discernment, accomplished in knowledge and good conduct, mindful, you will leave this great suffering behind. So this is a really famous metaphor that the Buddha used of the four horses. And this is kind of four grades of horses, from best to worst, or worst to best. And the best horse, as it says in the verse, doesn't need to be whipped, because even if it just thinks of the whip, or feels the shadow of the whip without an actual whip, that horse knows what to do because it's so well trained. Because the teachings have been internalized. It's a little bit like what Marilyn and I were saying in our conversation in the beginning. Is this a job and a piece of work, or does it just come naturally? Well, maybe the good horse has been done the work, right? And been punished and been whipped enough so that it doesn't need to be whipped anymore. So it's odd, the metaphor here in this context of this chapter is a little bit kind of ambiguous, because the metaphor of the horses seems to say, yes, you do need the punishment. You do need the stick. You do need the words that will straighten you out. Until you are straightened out, then you don't need them anymore. The best horse has been punished so much that it no longer needs to be punished. It's now well trained, which implies that the worst horse, well, you better whack him quite a bit with the stick till it straightens out. And it's a famous metaphor for us, because I couldn't find exactly where, but somewhere in Zen Behind Beginner's Mind, Suzuki Roshi talks very famously. It's a very famous passage about the four horses, and looks at it in a very, very different way. He says, he says, everybody always wants to be the best horse, and nobody wants to be the worst horse. But actually, he says, in practice, it doesn't really matter at all which horse you are, because everybody is all of the horses, at different times. So it's irrelevant, whether best or worst is completely irrelevant in practice. And anyway, he says, when it comes to actual practice, and here I think he's talking about specifically Zazen practice, but I think it holds up for all of practice, it's actually better to be the worst kind of horse. That's better. You're better off being the worst kind of horse. And he takes the idea of the whip not as a kind of punishment, but as suffering itself. And he says, and I've seen this to be exactly the case over the years, observing people practicing. If practice is too easy for you, he says, there isn't much suffering for you in the practice, then you'll be interested in it for a while, but you'll wear it out fairly soon. But if it's really hard for you to practice and you suffer a lot through your practice, and I think that we all do from time to time, you will learn your lessons well through the very suffering. And those lessons will really go in and they'll really mean something to you because they've come at a cost. So it's better to be the worst horse. It's better to suffer a lot in your practice, Suzuki Roshi says. And the final verse in this chapter, irrigators guide water, fletchers shape arrows, carpenters fashion wood. The well-practiced tame themselves. And you know, all of these things that are mentioned are crafts, you know, to fashion an arrow, to be a carpenter, a skilled carpenter, to be someone who knows how to manage irrigation systems. These are skills and crafts that we develop over time. And that's what practice is like. Practice really is a kind of craft or a skill that we develop, the craft of living our lives with wisdom and honesty and love for one another. That's a kind of a craft that we develop. You know, it's not something that is magical or that comes from out of the blue. It's something that we develop over time. And as Mahayana practitioners, who everything we think about is always conditioned by the teachings of emptiness, we don't hold on to the idea of craft, you know, in some literalistic way. But we do appreciate practice as a craft, putting on the robe, taking off the robe, you know, sitting, learning how to sit, learning how to strike a bell, learning how to beat the drum, learning how to chant the sutra. All these things in practice are crafts that we develop and that magnify our lives and make our lives more open and more kind. Practice gives us a craft, a way of life, something to develop, a direction, a way to go. And that's what these metaphors are suggesting. So I'm going to just go on and do the next chapter too. I was thinking today about the seminar in general and thinking that maybe we'll just do two chapters a week until we go through the whole book, because I think it's a kind of useful, and it's nice after doing the Gandavyuha Sutra, where we were absorbing many pages all in one time. We can literally read every word of this text and appreciate it if we go slowly. So we will probably do that. So here's chapter 11, old age. So this chapter is about what a bad deal it is to have a body that falls apart, that gets sick, that dies, that grows old, and therefore produces all kinds of anxieties and all kinds of difficulties and troubles. According to the Buddha, the only trouble, the real problem here, is not the body itself. The problem is that we take our body and our life so personally. We identify with our body so strongly that when the body starts to show signs of wear and tear and stuff starts happening to it, it makes us become very anxious. When you're young, you generally think, somehow without examining this thought, that nothing is ever going to happen to you, that neither you nor anyone important to you is ever going to die, which is a very unrealistic thought. And when you're old, you think the opposite. Bad things are definitely going to happen to you and everybody else, and it's going to happen like any day now, which is also equally unrealistic. But when you're older, you tend to think like that because you can see that your body is aging and this changes your mind, and you probably have lost a certain number of friends in your life. So these things become much more personal to you. Anyway, that's my experience, but I bet a lot of you can relate to it. But whether or not you're old, it doesn't really matter because you're aging. Everybody is aging. Children are aging. Every human being on this day is older than they have ever been before, and they're not going to go backwards. And the body is a very messy thing, full of actual troubles and potential troubles and all kinds of smelly things and weird pieces of flesh full of potential, if not actual, troubles all the time. And we truly believe ourselves to be the person we think we are. We believe it. So when the body gets messed up, it gives us a sinking feeling. The argument of this chapter is that since the body is inherently so radically vulnerable, we should not identify with it so much. We should disidentify and take refuge in nirvana, the unconstructed, as Gill translates, using a word that others have used when translating Dogen, some of Dogen's concepts. The unconstructed is not the body. Sorry, no. The unconstructed isn't not the body. The unconstructed is the same body, but without the strong and insistent identification. In other words, nirvana is just seeing the body and mind as a kind of occasion that one can enjoy and appreciate for its many advantages, but not necessarily take as one's true or actual self. So that's sort of what the Buddha is saying in this chapter, verse 146. Why the laughter? Why the joy? When flames are ever burning, surrounded by darkness, shouldn't you search for light? So that describes a person who doesn't notice that the world and the self are on fire and is sort of happily fiddling away while Rome is burning. From the time of the Buddha to the present, we have always been on fire. And the only thing to do in a case like that is to seek the cool water of wisdom, to shine some gentle light into the darkness, because that is the only way to cope with the situation that we're in. I'm going to read the next three verses. Look at this beautified body, a mass of sores propped up, full of illness, the object of many plans with nothing stable or lasting. This body is worn out, so fragile, a nesting ground for disease. When life ends in death, the putrid body dissolves. What is the delight in seeing these dull white bones tossed away like white gourds in autumn? This city is built of bones, plastered with blood and flesh, and filled with aging, death, conceit, and hypocrisy. So that's an unpleasant set of verses. Now, it's pretty obvious, right, that you could look at almost anything in a variety of ways. It depends on, what mood you're in and where you're standing and how you want to look at it. And you could certainly make a case that life is absolutely wonderful. It is great. It's exciting and great to be alive. And human bodies are totally beautiful. Everybody we see is beautiful, no matter how old or young they are. And it's an amazing world full of possibilities. Love is in the air. And we all know that we can have wonderful relationships that last a whole lifetime. We can have happy families. We can love our children. We can love our friends. We can make art. We can enjoy sunsets and sunrises and beautiful ocean views. We can go on great trips. Life is fantastic. And you can make a case for that, and it would not be untrue. It's really true. Buddha doesn't say that here at all, but it is true. However, if you force yourself to have that view and insist that that is the way it is, and I'm sticking to it, the result will be a lot of unhappiness because a lot of times, you're not going to feel that way. It's not going to look that way. And you will be shattered because you insist that it be otherwise. So the way that Buddha is depicting life here, physical life, is also just as accurate a way of looking at things as the fact of life being so wonderful. It's also true And when Buddha says, look at this beautified body, what he means by that is not look at this beautiful body. He means look at this body that is all dolled up and made to look fancy with, makeup and fashion and, maximum gym time and a personal trainer and all this. But just scratch the surface of that beautified body and it's not so beautiful. Look inside the body, look at the intestines of that gorgeous, healthy, buff person. Go inside the intestines, it's not so great in there, right? The body is smelly and grotesque when you look closely enough with instruments and you take away your fantasy and your desire about bodies. Yes, the body is full of all kinds of nasty things. It's true. And the body is really fragile and radically vulnerable. It's an accident waiting to happen, right? And even if you are successful, as I hope every one of us is, and we should definitely pay attention to this. It's part of our bodhisattva practice to keep our bodies healthy and relatively good looking. Because if we're healthy, we're going to be relatively good looking. And if we're kind and nice, we're going to be relatively good looking. We won't have scowls on our faces and look like crabs, you know? Even then, the body is going to age and die. And then we'll see its real nature. Putrid, decaying, really smell bad and doesn't look, you don't want to look, you don't want to hang around corpses. It's not fun. Body's not nice. It's a city made of bones, plastered over with flesh and blood. And inside it, there is, as he says, aging, deceit, conceit, and hypocrisy. Now, again, the Buddha is not a horrible curmudgeon. And he knows that the body, fragile as it is, could also contain loving kindness, happiness, sincerity, ease, peace. Because I bet the Buddha's body contained those things and not so much hypocrisy and so on, conceit. So the Buddha knows that. But here he is emphasizing this negative side for polemical reasons, because the whole point of the entire Dhammapada is to try to talk us into realizing that we have to practice. And he's using arguments to kind of show us that that's true. And he's doing that not so that he'll, I don't know, like get more hits on the website or something, because he's doing it because he knows that this is really good for us. He's trying to be helpful here. He's trying to talk us into something that he knows is really the only thing that's going to help us. Verse 151. Even the splendid chariots of the royalty wear out, so too does the body decay. But the dharma of the virtuous doesn't decay, for it is upheld when the virtuous teach it to good people. So now we get squarely to the aging part. The body wears out, just like a chariot wears out. The body wears out. Everything physical wears out. That's the nature of physical things, is that they wear out. Even rocks, wear away over the ages. In Zen, we have the tradition of the Dharma as a lamp that is passed on generation to generation. And the earliest texts that described the Zen teachers' encounters with one another were called transmission of the lamp texts. So the Dharma is light. It is consciousness, the true nature of consciousness, which is Buddha. And that light, since it is not a thing, it is not physical, it's not a body, it isn't anything at all, so it can never go out. It can't diminish or decay. Even if it appeared that the Dharma, as we understand it, went away, there's no more Buddhism, no more people practicing anywhere ever anymore. Even then, the Dharma wouldn't disappear because as long as there is consciousness, as long as anything at all exists, the Dharma exists. So we are dedicated, especially in our tradition, it's such a virtue and a value for us to pass the light on generation after generation. And even though everything changes, and every generation is different from every previous generation, and every culture and every person is different. Still, strangely and kind of wondrously, the Dharma, which must also be different because everything else is different, is also at the same time exactly the same. Just as throughout the universe, light is the same. Light is light, even though the things that light illuminates are different. And this is in contrast to all the verses that have come before. He's been going down all verse after verse about how corruptible and nasty this and this and this. But now, by contrast, the Dharma isn't like that. This light that is perfect and doesn't change is the opposite of the body of the physical world that does change and has the nature of falling apart. But the Dharma does not fall apart. The Dharma cannot fall apart, even though it is non-different from the physical world. It cannot fall apart. It's some aspect that is radically different. 152. A person of little learning grows old like an ox. The flesh increases, but insight does not. Well, I didn't know that oxen became overweight when they were old, which this is what the verse seems to be saying. They get fatter, but they don't get any wiser. I don't know if that's really what it's saying, but anyway, it's pretty clear that what it's saying is that you can improve or increase physically, but that's not the same as increasing spiritually. Though, sorry, the next verse, 153 and 154, through many births I have wandered on and on, searching for it, but never finding it, the builder of this house. To be born again and again and again and again is suffering. House builder, you are seen. You will not build a house again. All the rafters are broken, the ridge pole destroyed. The mind gone to the unconstructed has reached the end of craving. And as Gill notes in his commentary, these verses are said to have been spoken by the Buddha at the moment of his awakening. House builder, you've been seen through. The house is the body. Who builds this body? Where does it come from? Where is it going? The Buddha is saying that this was his quest, to find out who he really was, and in finding out who he really was, to end suffering. And he did. He finally found out. He saw that the builder of the house, this constructed craving self, is the builder of this house. It's an imaginary self that is naturally full of self-clinging and pride. The body and our feelings about the body and our attachment and identification with it come from this clinging. And once it's seen for what it is, the house falls down. The rafters of defilement pull apart, the ridge pole of ignorance is broken, and the house collapses and will never be built again. And again, it's a little bit like the broken bell. Here it is, the collapsed house. We would rather have it be like a nice house, right? Standing up, looking real nice with a good paint job, you know. Those of us who live in houses and like living in houses may find this metaphor a little unsettling, but of course it's meant to be inspiring. Because the house that Buddha is talking about here is a very confining thing. It's very confining. It's oppressive. It's a cause of great stress, because one spends one's life shoring it up at great expense, and every day the elements are pulling it down. And now finally it's revealed to be what it always has been, and now we have nothing to shore up. There's just open sky and open space all around. If the self is constructed and put together, nirvana is the opposite. It is the unconstructed. It is the allowing of everything to be as it is, without any need to push things around and make them into something else. And the final two verses for tonight, those who have neither lived the chaste life, nor gained wealth in their youth waste away like frail herons in a lake devoid of fish. Those who have neither lived the chaste life nor gained wealth in their youth lie around like arrows misfired from a bow, lamenting the past. And now these lines are really very squarely about the condition of old age. And the images, I think, are really kind of wonderful, very powerful and lamentable images. And you can really see this image, can't you, of an old skinny heron, you know, walking around maybe in the Bolinas Lagoon, fishing, barely able to like get the job done. And every time it dips down for a fish, there's nothing there because this is like a fishless lagoon. And you can imagine very sadly, you know, an old age like this, when you're looking all the time for some little snatch of pleasure, some little moment of happiness, just a little bit of satisfaction, but all the things that your whole life through gave you that satisfaction no longer do. You can't take any more drugs, alcohol makes you sick, rich foods you can't digest, the entertainment is boring, you can't have sex because you're all dried up, you can't go anywhere on an airplane, it's too hard. You're just dried up and there's nothing gives you pleasure anymore. No enjoyment. You're still fishing, right? You still have that desire to have some satisfaction. And so you're still fishing, but you're barely able to like walk along in the lagoon. And every time you try to be satisfied, it just doesn't work. The lake is totally dried up. Oh my God, can you imagine anything more sad than that? Oh, terrible. The second image, if anything, is even worse. Arrows lying on the ground, having been misfired by a bow. And this describes, like I say, a condition that might even be worse. Being very old and feeling as if you never actually have started to live your life. You never grabbed hold of your life. You never really lived your life. And now here you are, and it's too late, and it's not going to happen now. Maybe you think that you were scared, you know, and you just never gave yourself a chance to live because you were too frightened. Or maybe you tried to live and you went all around trying to find the life you were supposed to have, and you just could never find it, and you just sort of settled for something. Or maybe you felt that you were in some set of circumstances that you could not overcome that prevented you from living your life. But anyway, this is a different thing, you know, from the frail heron looking for fish. This feeling in old age of tremendous regret. Can you imagine feeling my life is practically over and I am so regretful. Every single year of my life, I regret deeply. I did not want to live this life and now it's too late. Oh my God. How horrible, what a fate. So here the Buddha is using these wonderful verses and these really powerful but very sad metaphors to describe what could happen to someone in old age if they haven't dedicated their lives even a little bit to wisdom. But there's another thing here that really interested me, and that you might not think of at first, because in the beginning of the first two lines that are repeated in both verses, the Buddha refers to here, he says, a person who has neither lived the chaste life, which means, you know, been a monastic and devoted themselves to practice, nor a person, and a person who has gained wealth in their youth. So in other words, he's talking about a person who has neither become a religious practitioner nor gained wealth in their youth. Such people who have done neither one of those things will suffer these horrible old age catastrophes. And so that's interesting because the Buddha doesn't usually say something like this. He seems to be saying here that even if you don't practice, maybe you don't practice at all and you don't devote yourself to wisdom, but you do try to live a prudent and a decent life. You know, you provide for your family and your community. In other words, rather than a misspent youth, you know, you've tried to take care of your life. Then he says, like someone who's practiced, you'll be okay in old age. You won't suffer these things in old age, which seems to be true, don't you think? I don't think we would want to say, oh, everybody is going to end up miserable unless they practice Buddhism. I don't think we would say that. That would be going a little too far. So anyway, that's the end of the chapter. And just as a closing note, I've gone on a while here, I'm sorry. I think that what this chapter makes me feel is that despite all the difficulties involved, I think that old age is the best time of life. So if you consider yourself to be an old person now, you're lucky. And if you're not an old person now, you have that to look forward to. Because I think that old age is actually the best part of life. Because when you're old, you have a lot less trouble. Even though there are troubles, you have a lot less trouble actually than you had before. Because a lot of the stuff that used to bother you just doesn't bother you anymore. Like, who cares? And while maybe it's true that the more complicated pleasures that require a lot of energy and trouble don't seem accessible anymore, on the other hand, simple pleasures are much better. You know, you really appreciate simple pleasures, and you can feel them and see them and have access to them all the time, all day long, practically. I mean, you appreciate it when you can walk across the room. Wow, look at that. The body is working. Look how I can walk. Look how I can breathe. Watch me. Look at the sky. Look at that. It's fabulous. You know, simple pleasures are much more impressive to you when you're old than they were when you were young. And maybe let's hope that there's a little bit of wisdom for having lived a long time. And there is a little bit of appreciation for what life is. And there's maybe some love that's uncomplicated and straightforward, and there's some compassion. And yes, definitely, there is a lot of sadness, I think, involved in being an old person, because there's no getting old without suffering losses that are really, really important and remain sad and sorry. And then there's, you know, looking at the world as an old person and seeing, wow, you know, I thought maybe it would improve over these last 60 or 80 years, but I don't know, it doesn't look too much better. And that's sad. But at the same time, I think because of wisdom, there's a great hope and a confidence in the process of life itself. There's some wisdom, you know, in living itself. And that will go on. You might be gone, but life will go on. You know that you're not identified just with this body, you're identified with your life. And life goes on even when your life doesn't go on. So I think all of that you can really feel in old age, and I think those of us who practice can appreciate what I'm saying here, that it can be very enjoyable and happy time to be old. And I don't know that you have to be a Zen practitioner or a Buddhist practitioner to feel all that, but I can tell you from personal experience that it sure helps. You know, it sure makes it more likely. I don't know that I feel pretty happy as an old person, grumpy as I may be. But I don't think I probably would be if it weren't for practicing. It helps. It really does. Anyway, that's 3 weeks worth of stuff that I wanted to tell you that I'm telling you all in one talk. So I think that we have time for groups very briefly. So let's do our usual groups of three. And maybe have just a quick one, just about 2 minutes for each person, so that we can have a chance to come back and chant. And just on a quick take, your reaction to this question of how the Buddha looks at the human body, and how do you look at the body? How do you feel about the Buddha's teaching in this chapter about the body and aging? So a quick take, 2 minutes. So, Shufi, if you'll put everybody into groups, and that'll be less than 10 minutes altogether, going in, coming out, and everything. Thank you, everybody, for listening.